created by the alignment every 11 years are strong enough to tug on material near the sun's surface and synchronize localized changes in its magnetic field. The study expands upon the commonly accepted model for solar dynamos and supports a long-held theory that planetary configurations are responsible for the sunspot cycle and magnetic solar cycle. As a giant spinning ball of plasma, the sun's magnetic field is extremely complicated. Its magnetic field lines start as parallel lines running from north to the south pole, but because the sun rotates faster at its equator than its pole, these pole-to-pole magnetic fields slowly wind and wrap around the sun, stretching like taffy from the middle of the line to become horizontal. Let me drop for a sec. On top of the rotational motion of solar plasma, convection moves material from the equator to the poles and back again. That twists the field lines around each other into loops and spirals. Now, the winding and the twisting of the sun's magnetic field lines are described by the alpha-omega dynamo model. In that model, alpha represents the twisting and omega represents the wrapping. Tangled field lines can create instabilities in the local magnetic field and cause sunspots, flares, and mass ejections. This model is the commonly accepted explanation for the behavior of the sun's magnetic field, but it's not perfect. It predicts that instabilities, twistedness, will oscillate randomly every few years. But the model can't explain why the number of sunspots waxes and wanes on roughly 11-year cycles, or why the sun's magnetic field flips polarity every 22 years. Another solar system phenomenon happens every 11 years. Venus, Earth, and Jupiter align in their orbits. These three planets have the strongest tidal effects on the sun. The first two because of their proximity to the sun, and the third because of its mass. Past observational studies have shown that minimum in the sunspot cycle have occurred within a few years of this alignment for the past 1,000 years or so. The researchers wanted to test whether the planetary alignment could influence the sun's alpha effect and force an interplanetary low tide at regular intervals. The team started with a standard alpha-omega dynamo model and then added a small tidal tug to the alpha effect every 11 years to simulate the alignment. The team that wrote this paper said that they had suggested a dynamo model that is not completely new, but built on old-fashioned or conventional alpha-omega dynamo models. The simulation showed that even a weak tidal tug of 1 meter, about a yard per second every 11 years, forced unstable magnetic twists to pulse with that same period. The simulated dynamo polarity oscillated with a 22-year period, just like the real solar dynamo. Let me drop for a sec. Because these magnetic instabilities are connected with solar activity, the researchers argued, this synchronization could also suppress or generate sunspots across the sun at roughly the same time. In other words, the sunspot cycle. The team published these results in Solar Physics in late May of 2019. Now, keep in mind that it's been opined in, that correlation is not necessarily corroboration. The example that I've used in the past is that everyone that dies has spent time in a bed in the previous 24 hours, but that should not suggest that lying in a bed kills anyone. Science is full of cautious people, so no one is popping corks for these guys for a Nobel Prize anytime soon. Steve Tobias is a solar dynamo researcher at the University of Leeds in the United Kingdom, who was not involved in this research. When he was asked what his opinion was on this paper, his reply was simply, this is an intriguing paper. But Tobias argued that the combined planetary tides, in his opinion, are too weak to directly set the length of the solar cycle. Plasma dynamics deep within the sun are the more likely cause, in his professional opinion. Nevertheless, he said, this study seems to show that even a tiny amount of forcing from tidal processes can resonantly synchronize the cycle. This counterintuitive results should be explored further by investigating the behavior of proxies conditions for solar activity, such as the production rates of isotopes of beryllium deposited in ice cores. One of the authors of the new paper responded that it was possible that other planetary systems might have tidally dominant planets that resonate like our sun does, but it's not likely that we'll be able to prove it. For most stars, they said the observations only go back 40 years. People are happy if they can identify two or three or even four periods. Only for our sun do we have the historical observations. So here we stand, an interesting model and data that shows some correlation leading to a very interesting theory. It'll be interesting to see what further research finds out. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, we'll move on to the next story then. We happy few that live in New York will soon have the chance to see for ourselves whether 5G is worth the hype. On this Thursday, September 26th, Verizon will expand its 5G network to include sections of the Big Apple. As usual, there's no love for Staten Island, but the four other boroughs, Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Bronx, will have some form of 5G connectivity starting this coming week. Unfortunately, Verizon isn't being too specific about where you'll be able to catch those sweet 450 megabits per second download speeds. And in Manhattan, however, the carrier says the network will blanket parts of Uptown, Downtown, and Midtown. Earlier this summer, Verizon expanded its 5G to include parts of Atlanta, Detroit, Indianapolis, and Washington, D.C. Once the network is active in New York City, Verizon will have 5G in 11 cities across the United States. The carrier hopes to launch 5G in more than 30 cities nationwide by the end of the year. While not included in next week's rollout, it's worth noting earlier in the month that Verizon turned on 5G across the Hudson in New Jersey at MetLife Stadium. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Tell me if you do GX.
Yes, Rich.
Roy, well, we need to buy new equipment to use the 5G capabilities.
This is America. Of course you need to buy a new toy to use 5G. It's new technology. You know, you might be able to get around some of the slower aspects of 5G, but for the most part, you're probably not going to see any improvement unless your particular cell phone has the proper circuitry to work 5G. So, you know, God bless America.
Thank you.
Okay, I guess on to the next story. We've spent some time discussing the first known interstellar object that was discovered, Oumuamua. Now get ready for the second one. The second interstellar object on record has visited our solar system according to astronomical observations made in recent weeks. But how does this new visitor differ from Oumuamua, the first interstellar object? Scientists have been eager to learn more about comet C/2019Q4, I think it's otherwise known as Borisov, since amateur astronomer Gennady Borisov first spotted it on August 30th. Follow-up observations determined that its orbit suggested its origin from outside the solar system. A comparison to the first interstellar object, Oumuamua, could provide an interesting perspective on what these objects are like generally. Astronomers discovered the first interstellar object on record, Oumuamua, on October 19, 2017, and were able to gather hundreds of observations of the object as it whizzed through the solar system. It was strangely cigar-shaped and seemed to accelerate as it traveled away from the sun. There has been some wild conjecture as to its origin and the cause of its acceleration, but less speculative debate has centered around whether the object is more like a rocky asteroid or a comet that released some gas and accelerated as the sun heated it up. Observations haven't seen evidence of a cometary-like tail, but a volatile, rich gas venting structure for Oumuamua provides the simplest explanation of its odd trajectory, according to a paper in the Astrophysical Journal. Let me drop for a sec. The new comet has slightly different features. For one, initial observations have already revealed a comet-like coma and a tail. Its orbit looks different as well. It has the kind of orbit that's more characteristic of what astronomers expected to see. Oumuamua made a really deep plunge into the solar system and came close to the sun. That's not the typical behavior that we might expect. Astronomers expect interstellar objects to be more like icy comets than rocky asteroids because of where they're presumed to have formed in their own star systems. As you go out from the star, the disk is cooler, so objects have more ice in them. They're presumed to be more like icy objects in our solar system's own distant Kuiper belt. Most of the stuff that gets ejected would have more ice on it, they would think. Astronomers also think that the object is a little larger than Oumuamua, though the hazy coma makes it hard to tell the comet's shape. Observatories have only just gathered enough evidence to conclude the object likely has interstellar origins, and their watching has been difficult since at present it's relatively close to the sun in the sky from our viewing angle on Earth. But thankfully, the object is traveling in towards the sun, which means we'll have more time to observe it versus Oumuamua, which was caught on its outbound journey. The scientists are hoping for more interstellar objects to see very soon. I hope they get what they want. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
KHUNSJ.
Yes, Sam.
Okay, we talked about Harry Common last week, and I looked it up. Everything you had was good. What caused it not to melt? Is it the ice comet? At the speed it's going, it won't melt?
A small amount of it melts and gives off water vapor, which is the comet's tail. But there's a lot of ice, and most of space is kind of cold. So only a small portion of the ice will melt and produce a comet's tail. So there's more than enough ice on comets to have those tails persist many, many, many revolutions around the sun.
Thank you, Roy.
Oh, VDH with a question?
Yes, John.
They can tell these objects are interstellar as soon as they know that the orbit is hyperbolic, right?
Yeah, but it does take them a little bit of time and effort to track what the path is, especially when it's close to the sun and somewhat difficult to actually pick out from the rest of the view. But yeah, that's the bottom line.
And most of these objects, I guess these two, they come in at a high plane, a high angle to the ecliptic, I think also, right?
Yeah, that's the thing is that, you know, as we've always talked about, angular momentum is conserved. So when this solar system formed, everything kind of got locked down with close to the same angular momentum going on. And so there's an actual plane that, you know, there's a couple of planets that kind of bounce up and bounce down, but it's always the same type of a plane. Whereas these interstellar things come off at an odd angle that's inconsistent with most orbiting debris in the solar system.
I see. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions or comments? Okay, here's a fun one. Science is a process. Someone thinks that he or she found something out for the first time or came up with a very useful model or a theory to explain something better, but none of this is delivered to us like the Ten Commandments. Scientists are still trying and failing to show that Einstein was wrong. Sometimes science makes the wrong turn for a little while, but quickly gets set back on a better path. And there are great scientists and not-so-great scientists, as there are great scholarly journals and not-so-great scholarly journals. The following story seems to suggest that this is the latter group of scientists and journals. Demonizing smartphones and millennials is a favorite pastime among certain segments of the population, and earlier this year there was an excellent opportunity for both when a science journal published a very dubious article claiming that using smartphones or tablets led to forward head posture, which caused a bony protuberance to grow on the back of the skull. This was quickly picked up and reported as, quote, smartphones causing young people to grow horns, end quote. The article was widely panned for its scientific inaccuracies, and now the journal Scientific Reports has published a correction to the article in an unusual and embarrassing move for both the authors and the journal editors. Let me drop for a second. The authors had to correct significant chunks of the paper, including material from the abstract, discussions, methodology, and results, and competing interest statements. In the abstract, all mention of smartphones and tablets was removed, and language was modified to relay the speculative nature of that information. The sentences, "we hypothesize enlarged external occipital protuberances or horns at the back of the head may be linked to sustained aberrant postures associated with the emergence and extensive use of contemporary handheld technology such as smartphones and tablets," was completely removed. Other changes included making it clear that there was no evidence for a causal link between horn formation and the use of screen devices, correcting wrongly labeled figures, and admitting that the data from the study came from a clinical database and not from a recruited study group. Perhaps most importantly, one of the authors of the paper sells services claiming to treat issues of forward head posture. This is clearly competing in interest in the study, which should have been disclosed immediately. The paper now states David Shahar provides posture-related services as a chiropractor clinician and posture-related advice and products through drposture.com. Scientific Reports is a large open access journal from the respected publisher Nature Research that does require peer review. However, due to the high number of articles it publishes, the editors have had to provide other corrections in the past. There was an issue of alleged plagiarism in 2016 study published there, which was later retracted. And this year, the journal also retracted a 2018 paper claiming that homeopathic remedies could treat pain in rats. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. I don't know if someone tried to make a comment. I just heard a lot of noise, so either it was just static or someone who's basically 100% noise, unfortunately. Okay, on to the next. NASA's Juno spacecraft recently caught an ominous view of Jupiter, which shows a massive black spot atop the giant, the gas giant's churning clouds. It looks rather scary, but there's a perfectly reasonable explanation. It's a shadow cast by Jupiter's extremely volcanic moon Io. Juno captured this stunning series of images on September 12th while participating in its 22nd Perigeux, or close encounter with Jupiter. The NASA spacecraft, which arrived at the Jovian system in July 2017, is in a highly elliptical polar orbit that brings it close to the gas giant's cloud tops and then out again into deep space. Juno was about 5,000 miles from the surface when its JunoCam snapped these images, and the probe is now on a trajectory that will take it over 5 million miles away from the gas giant before swinging back for its 23rd perigee, according to Universe Today. Juno is currently scheduled to perform around a dozen more perigees before the mission ends in July 2021. But the mission could be extended further into the 2020s. Fingers firmly crossed for that, because the images like these and others make the world go round. Let me drop for a second. This is about as close to a total solar eclipse as we'll ever get to see on Jupiter, the largest planet in the solar system. To be fair, it's more of an annular eclipse, because Io's shadow is not even close to covering Jupiter's entire surface. To be even fairer, we probably shouldn't be referring to this celestial event as an eclipse at all. It's more of a transit, similar to the way that exoplanets travel across their host stars, allowing astronomers to detect them from our vantage point on Earth. Still, the shadow is quite large, all things considered. Io is only slightly larger than the Earth's moon, and the large black circle is due to an optical effect in which the total size of an object's shadow, the penumbra, increases with the distance from the light source, in this case, the sun. A similar thing happens on Earth during solar eclipses, an effect that was beautifully captured from space in 2016. Io is the fourth largest moon in the solar system and the innermost of Jupiter's four Galilean moons. The volcanic moon is quite close to Jupiter, requiring just 42 and a half hours to make a complete orbit. In addition to being roughly the size of Earth's moon, Io is also at a similar distance to Jupiter, a proximity that contributes to its hyperactive geology. The gas giant's tremendous gravitational influence creates a tidal heating effect on the moon. Io is subsequently the most volcanic object in the solar system, featuring hundreds of volcanoes that produce plumes as high as 300 miles above its surface. We discussed how Io dissipates more energy per cubic volume than even our sun. We did that about 9 months ago, I believe, on Science Talk. As a final fun fact, Io's largest volcano, Loki, is predicted to erupt any moment, so there's potentially more news about this gnarly molten moon coming up in the next few days. And if it happens, I'll report it here. And let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Very good. That's a good report. That's more detailed than what I read. I'll cover the spacecraft itself, but very good on the shadow and everything. Another picture I had was not from Juno, but it was from New Horizon as it was passing, and they also show where Io and Jupiter, but from the equatorial view, this thing is from the polar view. I see the picture on that they posted, and it does look like a black hole right in the middle of the planet. Back to you, bro.
Yes, indeed, Paul. And I will, as always, post to roy.ac2gs.com links to this particular article that will have the pictures. It's a very nice, it's not overwhelming, it's a kind of a small version on the website, but it shows you what it needs to show you, which is this strange big black hole that looks like it's on the pole of Jupiter. So it's interesting. Every so often we find interesting things on planets and have to scratch our heads and figure out what the heck's going on. Any other questions or comments for this, or I'll move on to the next? Mm-hmm. Okay. BMW decided to paint one of its X. Auto show and put it in a room with flashing lights and a video screen. It's essentially like looking into the darkness of the heart of a black hole. Someone's idea of what gazing at Nietzsche's abyss might look like, but with a BMW badge, grill, and headlights. It really sounds like something you have to see for yourself because it is said the car loses all sense of dimension and looks like a silhouette even when the lights in the rave tent-inspired room are turned all the way on. But even the blackest black can't escape the power of lasers. A LiDAR outfit, Ouster, took one of its sensors into the room to see what they could see and caught the vehicle in all its X6 darker-than-dark glory. The sensor relies on a reflected laser and ambient light to see objects, and when you have something this black, there's very little reflectivity. Mark Frichtl, Ouster's co-founder and CTO, explained this his theory of why a pigment that just sucks up light was caught on the company's LiDAR system. He said, covering the X6 in Vanta Black reduces both laser and ambient light dramatically. At 1% total hemispheric reflectivity, it's 10 times less reflective than a typical low reflectivity scenario for specifying maximum ranges for LiDAR. The Ouster OS-164 LiDAR sensor is specced at a maximum range of 40 meters for a 10% reflective target. So there's a maximum range of about 22 meters for a target that's 1% reflective, like the VV2-coated X6. Let me drop for a second. In other words, it sees the car, but it needs to be very close to do so. Fortunately, some parts of the car are very reflective, so even at long distances, the Vanta Black X6 is visible. Certain parts of the X6 are designed to be extremely reflective, like the license plate and the retro reflector in the headlight and signals. Those parts could easily be picked up more than 100 meters away. Of course, BMW will never sell a car that's Vanta Black, but if someone decides to spend all the money on a custom paint job, the vehicle will still be detectable by sensors as long as they don't cover the entire vehicle, including the windshield. LiDAR has become one of the go-to sensors for most automakers to help vehicles see the road, especially for driver assistance features. In addition to adding redundancy systems that already have cameras and radar, LiDAR's ability to create high-definition images from the bouncing of light off surfaces from far distances gives vehicles a more robust piece of data about an object. This demonstration is further evidence that a suite of sensors on vehicles is always better than just one. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WP2GXM.
Yes, Rich.
Very glad BMW is deciding not to make this production car, because whoever would think of painting a car Vanta Black is not thinking clearly. Black cars already account for too many accidents on the road.
I agree with you entirely. I think it was just a marketing ploy on their part. It was something different. Someone in the ad agency or marketing thought it up. And it certainly got a lot of press, but you basically need to be a raving lunatic to get yourself a car that can't be seen by anyone. That's not the point of a car. Cars are for transportation, and you kind of have to be seen so that other cars don't travel in the same space that you're trying to.
Point.
Yes, indeed. We all agree. It's sort of a fascinating idea intellectually, and would I have liked to have taken a stroll in that room and seen what the abyss looks like? Yeah, probably, but no, I don't think, well, there's probably someone out there who would really love to have that car. There's always one guy.
WS2, and I double with you.
I'm sorry, Paul. I'm just saying that there's got to be one guy out there who would really like a Vanta black car, as crazy as that might be. What did you say, Paul?
Okay, yeah, maybe you're right. James Bond or something. Maybe good for the movies. I was wondering, did they say how they got this paint onto the car? Because isn't this Vanta paint, isn't this the carbon nanotube story?
Yeah, this is a nanotube technology, and everything is a patent, so it's a company secret. They don't really like to explain too much of how it's deposited, but I assume it's vaguely similar to how you spray paint things onto a car, only requiring a lot more technology.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering what the application was, you know. They put down a primer, you know. I mean, did they bake it on? Okay, we'll find out as time goes on. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed. Well, that's the problem. Sometimes when things aren't just general research science, when they're commercial science, you got guys who have a vested interest in keeping it as blurry and unrepeatable as humanly possible.
Okay, I remember you talking about this stuff a little many nights ago. This was the one where the guy painted the floor, made it look like a hole, and then there was another hole next to it, and the guy jumped in and actually fell into the real hole or something like that.
Yeah, I talked about Vanta Black, but the artist didn't actually use Vanta Black. He used the blackest paint that he could find. I believe, if I recall correctly, it was a museum in Spain. A tourist from Italy went around the ropes that were quartered off that area and decided to see if it was a real hole. Oh, well. But the problem is it was a real hole. He had dug a hole, but he had painted it blacker than black. So you couldn't really make out whether it was a hole or whether it wasn't a hole or whether it was something out of Looney Tunes where Bugs Bunny draws a black circle on the ground. But he injured himself, thankfully. He didn't do any lasting harm. And, yeah, we talked about that last year sometime.
Okay, oh, that's what it was. Okay. I'm starting to blur my topics. Back to you, Roy.
Okie doke. Anyone else with any comments or questions before I move on to the very closely related next story? Very well. Anyway, don't go off and order that new shiny Vanta black-coated BMW too soon, because the folks at MIT might have something even blacker than that for you. MIT engineers have cooked up a material that's 10 times blacker than anything else previously reported, capturing more than 99.995% of any incoming light. The material is made of vertically aligned carbon nanotubes grown on chlorine-etched aluminum foil, and it was discovered by accident. The researchers had actually been experimenting with ways to grow carbon nanotubes on electrically conductive materials such as aluminum to boost their electrical and thermal properties. The color of the resulting material surprised the team, and they only realized what they had invented after they measured its optical reflectance. The discovery is currently being showcased in an art exhibit titled The Redemption of Vanity at the New York Stock Exchange, where a 16.78 carat natural yellow diamond, for some no doubt artistic reason, has been coated in the material. Instead of a brilliant sparkling gem, the stone, which is worth an eye-watering $2 million, appears as a flat black void. Let me drop for a sec. However, the team says that the material has practical applications as well. According to Brian Wardle, professor of aeronautics and astronautics at MIT, it could be used in optical blinders that reduce unwanted glare to help space telescopes spot orbiting exoplanets. And he said the material could even get blacker still. Before MIT developed what it called the blackest black material to date, as we talked before, Surrey Nanosystems claimed that title with its original Vanta Black low-temperature carbon nanotube discovery. Surrey's material was capable of absorbing 99.96% of light, although its scientists claim the company's second-generation concept could be even darker than that. There are optical and space science applications for very black materials, and of course, artists have been interested in black going back well before the Renaissance, Wardle says. Our material is 10 times blacker than anything that's been reported, but I think the blackest black is a constantly moving target. Someone will find a blacker material and eventually will understand all the underlying mechanisms and will be able to properly engineer the ultimate black. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WV2GX.
Yes, Rich.
Do these black, I don't know if they say, but do these black coatings result in an increased efficiency to convert light, such as sunlight, into heating? Before, let's say you could create a solar heater using these black coatings, would that result in a better heater?
Well, I guess on the basis that it absorbs more light, yes, but it's probably not cost effective. You know, to get it down to an additional, what is it, 1/1,000,000%, this stuff's probably rather expensive. So ultimately, does it convert more light into heat? I would think so. That's the nature of it being more absorbent. Whether it's cost effective, probably not.
Well, maybe with time. WV2GX.
Well, yeah, that's the hope of everyone, that all this nanotechnology that's somewhat esoteric, if they finally figure some way of gearing it up for large manufacture, it'll become much more cost-effective. And, you know, in the same way that microwave ovens, when they were first invented, cost a ridiculous amount of money, and through technology and a large demand for it, it plummeted and became little more than a commodity. So I would think that a lot of nanotechnology and a lot of cutting-edge material research will produce a lot of great things. Some things probably won't pan out because, you know, everything doesn't pan out. So kind of looking forward to that.
WS2N again.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, I think he might be right. You know, in some certain applications, you know, if the photons are, you know, they're not disappearing. They're traveling, I guess, into the nanotubes. They're going down to the substrate. If that substrate was a solar panel, you know, it might increase the efficiency of that. You know, NASA, they're always looking for better solar panels for the space program. Sure, you're not going to take these expensive things and put them on your roof of your house. That would be too expensive. But, you know, NASA thinks nothing of spending, you know, millions and billions of dollars on all this advanced high technology. Maybe they could make a better solar panel for higher electrical output to their satellites or even the, you know, space stations.
Well, I mean, fundamentally, yeah, it makes sense to me. Energy cannot be created nor destroyed. So if the light goes in and doesn't come out, the energy of that light has to turn into something else, and for the most part, it turns into average kinetic energy of the material. The heat of it increases. Again, the problem as I see it is, as money bags as NASA is, I don't know what the cost for this material might be. And if you compare it, say, with the previous one that was 99.96% absorbable versus 99.95%, whether you'd be willing to spend, say, 20 or 30 times the price for that amount of improvement is dubious.
Oh, okay. I know they're always looking for something. Like the Hubble, the original Hubble had bigger solar wings. And then when they did an upgrade, the new ones were much shorter and not as fat. So, you know, I can imagine some new substance like this coming out, and, you know, the next space telescope, you know, it could be even smaller yet. You know, everything is weight with these guys. You know, you could have a bigger telescope if you have less weight for such things as solar panels. Okay, I'll let you go on, Roy. WS.
Yeah, I agree with you, Paul. I realize NASA is always looking into new technology. They're certainly not afraid of new technology in order to make things simpler, less likely to break, lighter, smaller, you know, all those things. And to a degree, money is almost no object. So, you know, it's always interesting to see what technology they're going to use for new designs. But again, you know, something like a hundredth of a percent improvement for X number of bucks, I think even NASA bean counters would kind of look at that somewhat confused. It'll be interesting to see. And the bottom line is being able to mass produce it and cut the cost of manufacture. And then hopefully it'll be ubiquitous under some circumstances where you need something that you just cannot ever see. I mean, it's really like just someone cut a piece of fabric out of space-time, and you're just looking at the blackness of space. Okay, here's another story. A Russian state weather agency named for the first time a few weeks ago four specific radioactive particles released by an explosion at a military test site last month that left at least seven people dead and has remained shrouded in secrecy after the incident. The Russian Meteorological Agency identified them as isotopes of strontium, two types of barium, and lanthanum, but asserted that radiation levels are now normal in cities near the accident, which occurred on August 8th in the country's north. All four particles form from radioactive gases released during nuclear fission, outside experts said, and might be expected to drift far from the site of their release. While shedding little light on the device that exploded earlier last month or the potential risk to people living nearby, the announcement did offer a hint that other still undisclosed heavier elements could have been released closer to the blast site. The statement from an agency whose main task is forecasting weather came as the latest data point to the gradual drip of information released by the Russian authorities, who have been slow to acknowledge a nuclear accident during a military test. Western experts and President Trump have suggested the explosion occurred while the Russian military was testing a novel type of cruise missile design that uses nuclear propulsion, which NATO referred to as Skyfall missile. President Vladimir Putin of Russia acknowledged last month that the explosion occurred during a test of a military device. Now, both Russia and the United States have ramped up the testing of new delivery systems for nuclear weapons as the disarmament treaties of the late Cold Era, Cold War era, broke down or expired. Let me drop for a sec. Russian officials have not conceded that the explosion involved the missile called Skyfall, but a month or so ago, a Russian diplomat for the first time spoke of the accident in terms of the purpose of such a missile. The diplomat, Alexei Karpov, Russia's envoy to international organizations in Vienna, blamed the United States for setting Russia on the path to developing a new device by withdrawing from an anti-ballistic missile treaty over 15 years ago. Mr. Karpov told a gathering of states that are partly of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty that the explosion did not involve a nuclear warhead and thus did not fall within the treaty's purview. Instead, he said the explosion was linked to the development of weapons, which he had to begin creating as one of the tit-for-tat measures in the wake of the United States' withdrawal from the anti-ballistic missile treaty. The Russian military initially reported that August 8th explosion near the village of Nononska on the White Sea in northern Russia released no contaminants, even as the local authorities at a city about 20 miles away reported a spike in radiation levels. More information and misdirection soon followed. In Moscow, some television channels blinked out on the night of the accident. Screens turned blue and broadcast a warning for residents to remain indoors because of a storm with strong winds. Automated sensors that form part of the international network of radiation monitors, which may have provided more clues about what happened, mysteriously stopped transmitting results. Doctors and nurses at hospitals in the city of Arkhangelsk, about 40 miles from the blast, said that they were not warned that patients arriving from the site were contaminated with radiation and treated them without protective clothing. Later, when one of the doctors was found to have a trace of radioactive cesium-137 in his tissue, the regional government issued a news release saying the contamination was, with some degree of certainty, unrelated to the accident. The doctors likely ate elements unwittingly in fish, mushrooms, lichens, and seaweed, or another food fouled earlier by the fallout from some other unsuspected incident, the statement said. Let me drop for a sec. Officials told the contaminated man he had probably ate Fukushima crabs while on vacation in Thailand, according to Medusa, a independent news site, citing a fellow doctor at that hospital. The identification of the four radioisotopes by Russian meteorology agency came 18 days after the explosion and noted that the samples taken in the city in the 15 days after the explosion contained strontium-91, barium-139, barium-140, and lanthium-140. Earlier, the same weather agency said a cloud of inert radioactive gas had set off radiation meters in the city. The four isotopes are solids formed from the decay of two radioactive inert gases created from fission of uranium or plutonium. The presence of these isotopes miles from the site of the accident suggests heavier, more dangerous contaminants, such as plutonium, cesium-137, or radioactive iodine, likely fell into the sea. Greenpeace, the conservation group, issued a statement saying that the presence of these isotopes suggested cesium-137 was also released. Let me drop for a sec. As the week progressed, Western intelligence agencies suggested that this mishap was not caused by a test failure of a possible nuclear-powered cruise missile, but rather from Russia's failed attempt to actually clean up after a fifth failed test, where the latest test device fell into the sea. Reportedly, this device might utilize a molten sodium reactor, which is more efficient than steam-driven, but is prone to explode when in contact with water, you know, like you find in the ocean. Now, there are reports about two pontoons involved in this disaster, and they've been left unguarded on the shore near a village despite high radiation readings, according to a video release. No doubt more information closer to the truth will slowly leak into the press, and eventually, in a few decades, perhaps a TV series like Chernobyl will be produced for the entertainment and edification of us all. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, here's another one. Scientists claim to have finally found a plausible theory for the sightings of the Loch Ness Monster. I kid you not. She's not an aquatic reptile left over from Jurassic era or a circus elephant that got in the water to bathe with her trunk aloft. If Nessie ever existed at all, she was more likely a giant eel, according to a new scientific survey of the Loch. Starting with an Irish missionary's report of a monster in the River Ness in 565 A.D., repeated sightings in the modern era have kept Scotland's greatest myth alive, the most famous of which is a grainy photo from 1934, which appears to show the shadowy outline of a long-necked creature bobbing on the water surface. Until now, such glimpses were all people had to go on, but a new technique allows scientists to sample all the life contained within Loch Ness. By gathering environmental DNA, otherwise known as eDNA, this genetic material that's present in the cells of organisms and shed into the surrounding environment. Finding the and identifying eDNA can tell scientists what organisms are living in a habitat without them having to observe or capture them. Speaking from the village on the west shore of Loch Ness, scientists announced the results of their eDNA survey of Loch Ness. The team took well over 200 one-liter samples of water from throughout the loch, including the surface and the deep water, and compared them with 36 samples from five monster-free lochs nearby. Their census provided a list of all the species that call Loch Ness home, from bacteria to plants and animals. The study detected over 500 million DNA sequences and 3,000 species, according to Neil Gemmell of the University of Otago in New Zealand, who led the study. There were no DNA sequence matches for sharks, catfish, or sturgeon. That rules out large exotic fish in the loch. There are DNA matches for various land-living species that you would expect to see around Loch Ness, including badgers, deer, rabbits, voles, and different birds. Sheep, cattle, and dogs appear on the record alongside humans, too. This suggests that the sampling is pretty good at picking up species that would only rarely visit the water, so it should be able to detect a monster living permanently in the loch. Let me drop for a sec. The most popular representation of Nessie is as a plesiosaur, an ancient long-necked marine reptile that died out alongside the dinosaur in the late Great Mass Extinction 65 million years ago. The most popular theory of Nessie, that she is a plesiosaur that somehow survived the mass extinction of dinosaurs, may finally have been put to rest. Mark Whitten and Scottish geologist Hugh Miller discovered the first British plesiosaur bones on the Scottish Isle of Eigg in 1844, but according to Gemmell, there's not a single reptile in our vertebrate data, and nothing that sat in the expected place that a plesiosaur's DNA sequence might be predicted to lie, somewhere between birds and crocodilians. The most likely candidate for Nessie that has surfaced in media reporting the research is a giant eel. This appears to be based simply on the fact that eel DNA was detected at pretty much every location sampled in Loch Ness. Plenty of eel DNA doesn't confirm that Nessie is a giant eel, only that there are a lot of eels there. Scientists don't have monster DNA to compare with anything they found in the loch, and so no one can say for sure if there is or isn't a monster there. But the absence of anything unusual in the DNA record of Loch Ness suggests there's nothing to get too excited about, and that includes giant eels. If Nessie doesn't exist, why do eyewitnesses' accounts of Loch Ness monsters persist? Well, the answer is likely to be a psychological phenomenon called expectant attention. This happens when people who expect or want to see something are more likely to misinterpret visual cues as a thing that they expected or wanted to see. Let me drop for a second. This likely also happens with recently extinct animals. The last known Tasmanian tiger died in 1936, and exhaustive scientific surveys have failed to turn up any evidence that they are still out there. Even so, people often still report seeing them. Still, Gemmell acknowledges that there is uncertainty. Seals and otters, two species known to appear in the loch at least occasionally, weren't detected, while 20% of the DNA collected was listed as unexplained. That's normal for eDNA study, but it does leave room for a monster. The YouGov poll in August 2018 found that 24% of Scots believe that Nessie exists. First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, is apparently among them. Science being science, we can never say with total confidence that there's no Loch Ness Monster. The Loch's thriving tourism industry can still count on a little mystery to attract true believers. Rest easy, monster hunters. Nessie lives on. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, it's coming up to 11 o'clock, and don't really have time for another story, so I will say my thank yous to Dick and Paul and everyone who participated, and I'm glad that my little jury-rigged system worked as nicely as it seems to have. I will not be around next Sunday for that technical net because Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, will be coming down at dusk next Sunday. But I will be there with you in spirit, and I will be back the following Sunday with hopefully a lot of new good stories and maybe a few more puzzles. So I just want to thank everyone, and let me turn it over to Dick so that he can turn it over to Paul.
Very fine, Roy. We're going to miss you next week. Loch Ness, if he really did exist, some people believe it's a prehistoric dinosaur-like thing. The DNA of dinosaurs, I think in a few cases they found some DNA that hadn't deteriorated in the teeth or in certain bones, is a prehistoric animal, like a dinosaur. To your knowledge, is the DNA substantially different from modern-day animals? Over to you on that one, Roy, if you happen to know.
Well, according to the article and other things that I've read, they sort of want to place it somewhere between dinosaurs basically evolved into birds. That's where they come from. So it should have some differences, but enough similarities to birds and earlier reptiles that you can sort of fit them in between the two groups of organisms. And I'm not quite sure if that report was about dinosaurs, because 60-odd million years is a heck of a long time, even in teeth or such. I have read reports of relatively old bones, you know, going back not a million years, where they've been able to get some DNA from inside teeth. But I'm not quite sure if that was dinosaurs.
Is the DNA of a plant, in general, substantially simpler than the DNA of an animal?
Not necessarily. I mean, unfortunately, you can't go... It's very difficult because we haven't really sequenced everything. We've sequenced a few organisms. We did the Human Genome Project. You can't do it based simply on the number of chromosomes, because relatively simple life forms can have a lot more chromosomes than human beings. So numbers doesn't particularly show. Unique base pairs don't definitely show because a lot of them could be nonsense base pairs. There's a surprising amount of complications in simple plants and animals. That's the kind of the backbone of most chromosomes. The fiddly details of turning a reptile into a human being is surprisingly not that extreme. Most of the genetic coding is just for the way that the cell maintains itself, which is kind of built into all the cells.
And most people will consider a huge difference between the intelligence and capabilities of a chimpanzee versus a human. But I suspect the DNA difference is extremely small, and I think you did mention that once before. Thank you, Roy. Paul, are you at all concerned by the fact that some of the NASA officials are now saying that to put man/woman on the lunar pole by 2024 is a steep requirement because it requires a gateway. A gateway is a kind of a international space station, so to speak, but it's going to be going around the moon. So that gateway hardware has to be developed, debugged, produced, launched, assembled, and then you send up the astronauts, cosmonauts,